everyone, and welcome to this edition of our Seven Investing podcast. I'm Seven Investing founder and CEO Simon Erickson. We have been talking a lot about the space economy in recent weeks, and I'm very excited and pleased to introduce our guest of the program today. We have Andrew Channon is the founder and CEO of Procure AM, and we also have Micah Walter Range. He's the president of Kalis Partners. The two of them have together created the very first space-themed ETF, which has the ticker UFO. Andrew and Micah, it's really nice to talk to you again. Thanks for joining me on the Seven Investing podcast this afternoon.
Thrilled to be here. Thanks for having us. Okay.
We'll dig into kind of a lot of things on this interview today, but I've got to start the first question with you, Andrew. A reminder for anyone watching, this is the second time we've chatted with both Mike and Andrew. We spoke with them last April, and it's been already a year and a half since then. But I'm so excited about this topic that I've got to ask you the same question that I asked then, Andrew, which is, when you went out and created a space-themed ETF, 10,000-foot level, man, what is so exciting about this industry, and why do you want to invest in it so badly?
Well, so for me, you know, anytime I try to bring out a new fund or investment vehicle, I want to be first to market, and I want to be providing investors with access to industries, technologies, themes that they may not be able to as easily get exposure to, because it doesn't exist in an ETF form. And to me, space is one of those themes that is just so innovative. There are so many different types of companies involved in the space industry. And I truly believe that this is an industry that people want to invest in. And for many people, trying to pick one or two names to play that theme can carry a lot of risk. So for me, being able to partner with an index providing team that I believe truly understands the space industry, the companies involved, how they interact with each other, to me was extremely important, because when you provide a thematic ETF, you really want to try to provide that specific themes exposure for the end investor, or else you're not really doing them a great deal of good as far as giving them what they're trying to invest in. And, you know, for me as well, I'm always looking at themes that I believe have, you know, potentially long-term opportunities. And space is something where we're still in the very early innings. And seeing the new innovation and the new companies coming to market, for me, is just so exciting. And I believe that investors were looking for a basket approach to be able to get instant global diversification to this critical theme.
That's perfect. And first of all, congratulations on being first for this. I'm already seeing the space economy described as a $1 trillion opportunity. Since there's a lot of excitement, especially in the media recently, you guys were the very first space-themed ETF. Where do you think we stand with investors? Do they understand the opportunities in the space economy? Are there certain questions that you find that they're asking a lot right now? How does the investing community think about this space?
Well, I think that space is something that has a lot of different definitions to many different people. And having, you know, any two people agree on what the definition of space is, is pretty difficult. But the approach that our index team took when developing this index was really looking at revenues derived from space. And believe it or not, that was a pretty kind of breakthrough approach to space investing. And so UFO is the first pure play global space ETF on the market. And it provides investors with exposure to over 30 publicly traded companies from around the world that are doing all different things across the space industry. And I think for beginner investors, for institutional investors, for many different individuals or groups and organizations that want to get exposure to space, looking at the actual companies that are deriving their revenues from space, to me made a lot of sense as far as providing a kind of a basket vehicle for people to get this instant diversification to this theme. And, you know, keep in mind, you know, indexes are, you know, in many cases they're living, breathing, kind of products. And so just because something is in the index, you know, today doesn't mean it will be in tomorrow. And just because something's not in the index today doesn't mean it can't be eligible to be included in the future. So for someone looking to invest in a theme, an ETF could provide, you know, a lot of, interesting reasons for them to consider it, being that they could invest in something like UFO today. And as revenues are changing and companies are changing, they will be invested in something that has these, you know, new revenue weights and whatnot as time goes on. So, I think many people think of, you know, spacecrafts and, you know, launching things into outer space, but space is just so much more today, and we're more dependent on space than ever before. And it's become such a critical industry that, you know, to some people, they may consider things that, you know, are very far off, that are just have a little piece of, you know, space technology that helps them be, you know, usable as space. To some people, it means, you know, something needs to, you know, everything about that company needs to be all the way out in outer space. But for us, you know, the real, you know, focus are companies that are deriving revenues from space.
Absolutely, Andrew. And as in full disclosure for anyone listening to this program, I did buy into the ETF personally. I've held it since I've chatted with you guys about a year and a half ago. I'm probably going to hold on to it for the next decade. So I really believe in what you're doing. It's pretty exciting. Let's drill down.
Thank you. That means a lot to us. I really appreciate that, Simon.
Yeah, absolutely, Andrew. Michael, let me use that as a segue, what Andrew said there about things being a little farther off, to talk about some of those 30 constituents that you have, because you have the space index that actually feeds into the ETF, and you've been very methodical about how you've designed that index. You know, I saw that 20% of a company's revenue must be obtained for anything that's in there from something that is space related, and 80% of the index has got companies that have at least 50% of their revenue derived from space today. Can you talk a little bit about how you're kind of methodically designing this?
Yeah, absolutely. And it goes back very much to what Andrew was alluding to. And it's the fact that space is simply embedded and interwoven through just about every industry and just about every company today in one way or another. And you think about all of the location-based apps and services. You think about how, you know, computer networks use the timing signals from GPS satellites just to keep everything in sync. Particularly relevant today and, you know, over the next few days. You know, we'll see how the weather goes, Andrew. You know, it looks like another storm may be heading our way, but we can see that because of weather satellites. So, good luck to you in New York. We're looking at all of these different things and saying, you know, how do we sort out which companies are ones that make sense to include in an index? And so, you know, by having that threshold that they need at least 20% of their revenue to come from space-related activities, that lets us weed out the, you know, honestly, thousands of companies that have some small portion of space-related activity. You know, because at that point, you might as well buy a whole market index. that's what you're talking about. And that's not giving thematic exposure. So we've got that threshold. And then, you know, beyond that, you know, we also want to look at what are the pure play companies. So there are a lot of big, important companies in the space industry, you know, Boeing and Lockheed Martin and Airbus, you know, that do billions of dollars in space business every year. But it's still a very small part of what they do. So you want that nice balance between these diversified companies that are critical, that provide many of these essential capabilities that we all use. And then you want the pure play ones that you can point to it and say, well, clearly that's a space company. It's nothing but a space company. And that is what we want to be, you know, represented in the majority of the index. So we get this nice balance, and ultimately, because it's all rules-based, you know, it's not just, you know, me sitting down and saying, well, I like this company, I like that company. You know, we have a process, we go through it, it's very systematic, and we're tracking all the companies as they come to market. And I'm sure that's something we'll get into a little bit more about how the population is changing of those companies. And so we look at it and say, well, you know, where does this go? Is this a pure play space company? Is it not? And you know, even then, it's been interesting. I've seen a lot of people talking about, electric aircraft and how those might be space companies and, you know, all of these autonomous taxi systems. And I won't lie, I find them fascinating. But I don't think that's the primary thing people are buying. You know, they're buying the, you know, electric aircraft component, that mobility piece. So again, you know, space is at the cutting edge. It's embedded into many of these cutting edge products. And that doesn't necessarily make these space companies. So, you know, I think it's something that, well, analysts and index providers and And all of us who look at these things are going to keep debating, and that's very healthy. But I'm happy with where we're at and the methodology we have. And it seems to be working because it's ramping up to include a lot of these new companies as they come to market.
Yeah, it's a great point that space itself isn't necessarily an industry, right? Parts of it will embed themselves into any tech company, whether that's PNT, whether that's GPS, whether that's any of those other acronyms that are so used everywhere. They're all going to be using outer space in a couple of years. Micah, how long does it take for a company to embrace putting satellites up into orbit and actually kind of understanding what is capable, what they can do in outer space? Is this something that a company could turn something around in 2 years, or are companies just starting to even understand what a satellite could be used for imaging, for anything that they might do in outer space? I mean, what's the kind of time frame that it would take for commercial enterprises to embrace space technologies?
Well, to use space, you can do it tomorrow. It's pretty straightforward. And you know, the way that you do it is very much dependent on what your business is. So, you know, if you're in agriculture, you know, we can go back to the weather examples and satellite imagery of your crops, and you know, even just understanding, you know, the way water moves across your land. I mean, that type of thing is incredibly valuable if you choose to use it. And so you've got that, but then if you're talking about logistics and transportation, you're probably already using space. You know, if you're in the financial services, you know, again, the network timing component is so important. But you know, let's say you're a car manufacturer, and we've had an example of this in recent years in China. Geely has decided that it's going to have its own satellite network, and I assume the thinking is, you know, as people spend more time in their cars, you know, how do you provide connectivity? How do you make that part of the product? Satellites are great because, you know, they can reach you wherever you go. And so I think we're seeing experimentation with space. And that's an example where you have a company that is definitely not a space company, but it's saying, well, what if we had our own satellites? You know, what does that do for our business? How does that change the way we operate? And what opportunities does that open up? So I think we're going to continue to see more of that. And one of the drivers for that is the cost of access to space has gone down. The cost of building functional satellites has gone down. And you know, there's still a huge range of capabilities between, you know, a satellite that can fit in your hands versus one that's, you know, the size of a bus. You know, just simple physics dictates that those are not going to have the same capabilities. But you can still do a lot with that small satellite that you hold in your hands if you have the right business model and if you have it, you know, built and put in the right place and you've thought through the entire process. So, you know, that diversification, that opening up of opportunity is something that I think companies and countries around the world are still waking up to and beginning to grapple with and say, how do we integrate this?
It's a great answer. I've got a couple more questions I want to ask to you all as investors, for both of you. So please feel free, you know, Andrew, if you want to answer this first, or Mike, I'll let you all handle how you answer these. But kind of to frame the question, we just spoke with Peter Beck earlier this week for the program, who's CEO, founder of Rocket Lab, right? So day to day, he's living this, he's doing the operations, he's creating the rockets that are sending satellites up into space. And he's talking about, exactly like you said, Mike, a lot of these are kind of bespoke applications, right? They want to put a satellite to see out how it's working out there, and then they might scale it up more and more over time. Constellations, you know, larger satellites, he's building larger rockets to handle larger payloads. But my question, I think my first question for you all as investors who are looking at this from a very different perspective is, how do you think about the role of NASA and even just of governments in outer space, right? Right. So much of the technology has come from government-funded research, whether it's from NASA or from some other country, that's then gone into things that make it into the commercial economy. And certainly there's some national interests of countries want to protect their own borders and do things in outer space that would also be security concerns for them as well. but there's such an opportunity from this as well. I mean, like maybe at the higher level, how do you think about the relationship between government and government-funded research and things like NASA, and then like commercial opportunity of going out there and trying to make profits in outer space?
I'll lead off here. What NASA and governments around the world and space agencies around the world do for the space industry is fantastic. There's an incredible amount of spending that they're doing for some incredible projects that make life for everyone on Earth better. And to the extent that they're able to continue to raise money from government budgets in order to get their funding that they need to achieve these various goals that they have, that's something that's fantastic for the space industry. To the extent that new companies and new entrants can also enter the field and try to bid for a contract, and may the best technologies win. I think that's great for any industry, and it puts kind of a floor on spending for this industry, which is absolutely critical. That said, back in the day, governments and agencies represented almost 100% of spending on space and for the overall space economy. And right now, that amount that they represent is getting significantly smaller as time goes on. And it's gone from 100% to down to closer to 20%, where the commercialization of space and the commercial side has significantly increased and eaten up a big piece of that pie. So I think, from just having money being spent on these various endeavors, and a lot of it's not just to do the same thing over and over again, it's to actually develop new technologies. And in many cases, we're able to find new applications for those technologies that benefit us here on Earth that maybe weren't the primary drive for those technologies being created in the first place. So we've seen phenomenal knock-on effects for humanity just from the spending that we've seen. That said, I think there's opportunity for many different players, but by NASA going out saying, hey, we don't need to develop everything ourselves, we're happy to contract it out to third parties that can do it economically and get us to where we want to go, that's great, because it opens up these opportunities for new entrepreneurs to come out with new ideas and solutions, as well as for those existing companies that are there to say, hey, we know exactly how to do this. We've done something very similar, and we think that if we tweak this and do that, we might be able to get you where you're going even faster.
And I'll add to that, because that kind of question is exactly what Kalos Partners was set up to address. So we're a strategic consulting firm that lives right at that intersection between space and finance. But if you're doing anything related to space, you have to understand the geopolitical situation. You have to understand that relationship between government and industry. And the reason it's so important is that the commercialization of space is actually a national security issue. And this is something that governments, I think, are increasingly understanding. So, you have two different options ahead of you if you want to establish a really strong position in space. One is to either pay for everything from the public purse, or to have commercial industry step up and rapidly build out capabilities that then you as a government can call on whenever you need them, whether it's commercial satellite communications or Earth observation, being able to detect what other countries are doing around the world, intelligence gathering, all kinds of things. And so, when you look at it that way, governments have this huge impetus to really stimulate the growth of their commercial industries. And they can do that by direct interaction, funding early stage companies. And we see a lot of that going on right now, particularly the US government on the civilian side from NASA. Yes, absolutely. But with the Space Force ramping up and Space Command and everything else, there's a lot of funding going into these early stage companies to say, these are needs that the nation has. We want these technologies developed. We don't want to pay for everything ourselves, because that just gets to be ridiculously expensive. So we want you, space industry, to figure out how to deliver these capabilities with a little bit of pump priming from the government, but mostly private capital coming in and You know, if private capital is coming in, you better be looking at commercial markets as well for the same capabilities or related capabilities. So it's really pushing the industry, I think, in a useful direction to meet those national needs, but also to explore the commercial opportunities. And I think that, you know, for some of the older space companies, that can be challenging because they're used to just having one customer, and that is the government. And now they're being told, well, go find customers in all those other markets that, you know, make up the rest of the global economy. We help some of them with that. But, you know, it's a process. And I think it's a good thing for the industry, you know, as it continues to mature.
Can we talk more about that, Micah, double-clicking exactly what you said as it's maturing as an industry? It's fascinating to me, right? When you have a entirely government-funded program, you've got one customer and then you've got contractors that have requests for proposals. You try to win the bid, you do business with the government. Now you've got Richard Branson taking video of himself floating in zero gravity because he wants to put attention on Virgin Galactic and you know, wants to encourage people taking, you know, entertainment trips, recreational trips into outer space. And Elon is wanting to disrupt everything, right? He wants to start from scratch and just rewrite the entire canvas of how the defense contractors or anybody else who's bringing payloads to the ISS has done things for decades. How do you think about billionaire entrepreneurs and SPACs who are raising money from investors and this entirely different way of commercialization of space? How is this impacting the industry right now? How is this mature industry evolving right now?
Well, as has always been the case, the incumbents, of course, you know, sit back and tut tut, and you know, that'll never work, and you know, they clearly don't know what they're talking about, and they have more money than sense, and all the rest. And I think people are less likely to do that after experiencing SpaceX being around for a decade plus and getting thoroughly disrupted by that. So, you know, you don't want to make the same comments about whoever the next SpaceX is going to be. That just, you know, doesn't look good on your resume. And so, yeah, I at the same time, I think there is a willingness to work. And in fact, we see a lot of partnerships now between established companies and emerging companies, and a lot of direct investment as well. So corporate venture capital flowing into a number of these startups, it's really quite substantial because they're looking ahead to, you know, how do I get that next generation of technology? I either develop it in-house or I just start investing in this startup and maybe they're an acquisition down the road. Or alternatively, maybe they go public through a SPAC and, you know, then I cash out and now my public shareholders are very happy with that result. So, you know, lots of different directions that can go. But, you know, thinking about the role of the billionaires in particular, you know, they've certainly brought a lot of attention to the industry, some of it positive, some of it not so positive. And because of that very high profile nature of what they do and how they do it, I think it has led to a lot of soul searching on things like environmental impact. You know, it's one thing to say, you know, we're launching weather satellites that, or climate satellites that, you know, taught us about climate change in the first place. They provided the data so we can see that happening. It's another thing to say, well, you know, we're putting rich people in space because it's fun. Okay, well, you know, what's the carbon tax on that? I don't know. Should there be one? Should there not be one? And so we now see things like the new spaceport, one of the spaceports that's being set up in Scotland, is branding itself as the greenest spaceport ever. And they're looking to be completely carbon neutral. So, you know, I think the additional scrutiny is very healthy for the industry as a result of some of these high-profile people. And then when it comes to the SPACs and the companies that are going public through that route, again, I'm really excited about it as an index builder, because it's a different type of company that's going public. And looking back at the early days of the index and even how it is now, for the most part, you get this mixture of companies that are mostly in that diversified group, where space is a part of what they do, significant part, but definitely not the majority. And that tends to be where most of the hardware manufacturing takes place. And then you have the pure play space companies that are more on the operational side. So satellite operators, satellite TV providers, things like that. And with this new generation of companies, yes, you get some like Rocket Lab that are just focused on launch. You know, that's the thing they're doing, building hardware, building satellites too now. Not so much on the operations side, but then you have others that are doing both. So they're building their own hardware. They're flying their own hardware. They're experimenting. You know, that gives them a different way to generate revenue and a different approach to how they generate revenue. And so the question for me is, you know, will that prove successful? You know, as they are public companies, will investors see the value in what they're doing and how they're doing it? And we don't know yet. And so there's this huge experimentation that's going on, you know, in the financial market side of things that, to my mind, goes very nicely with the technological experimentation that's enabled by cheaper access to space and less expensive satellite hardware.
Anything to add to that, Andrew? Any thoughts about the SPACs that have gotten a lot of popular support or kind of how you evaluate management out there?
Yeah, so you know, the index itself, and therefore the fund, doesn't invest in companies that are necessarily the targets of SPACs. However, once a SPAC has successfully merged and de-SPACed, then it can be brought into consideration for inclusion. So, you know, certainly we're monitoring the SPACs and the deals that are out there. But just because something, you know, some SPAC says, hey, we're going after this company, doesn't mean it's automatically included, even if it is a space company. So it's something that's kind of put on the watch list, you could call it. That said, you know, a tremendous amount of attention has been brought to the space industry, whether you're rooting for the billionaires and their space dreams to come true or you're rooting against them. They have brought a tremendous amount of attention in media and investments into the space industry. And that's something that the space industry has needed for years. And we're seeing this interesting turning point where, you know, now we're seeing a tremendous amount of coverage. And this is all opening up people's minds to the idea of investing in space. And you know, certainly not all SPACs are created equal. Not all private companies, public companies are created equal. So, you know, for any of them, it's, you know, it's investor beware. And, you know, another reason that, you know, I think many people look to an ETF to get that diversification, so they're not putting all their eggs in one basket for their space exposure. But, you know, certainly I'm thrilled to see the amount of capital that's going into these various SPACs and private companies that are now IPOing. I think it's ultimately, it's something that the industry had been missing for years. And now seeing that these companies and ideas and technologies and products can get access to capital when they need it is something that could inspire the next range of entrepreneurs that say, you know what, space is investable. We can create profitable companies. And when we need the capital, we can access it. That's a big change from where we were before with many of these companies basically living or dying by their ability to get a government contract. So I think overall, it's a positive trend change for the industry. And you know, we're grateful to see that investors are paying attention.
That's a great point, Andrew. You know, it's interesting. It's something we've been watching a lot too at Seven Investing, right? How do you evaluate companies that are raising funds in a SPAC vehicle, then the merger is complete, and then they go off and they can do the operating thing with the business that they've merged with? Of course, one thing that we've started seeing with SPACs that was not quite as common with IPOs is the hockey stick, right? You see the revenue projections, you see it just hockey stick where 5 or 7 years from now, it's just going to take off, you know, and we're going to say, oh, it's going to be 10x within a 2-year period of time. It's giving them a lot of funds efficiently raised from a SPAC, but it's also, you know, all of those companies certainly, or at least I don't think it's going to be possible for all of those companies to execute as well as they're projecting. And so I guess my question, and maybe this one's initially for you, Mike, is how, other than sales, other than pure sales growth, and a lot of them are reporting EBITDA too, but are there other metrics you think that investors should be paying attention to as they're evaluating how well these companies are actually doing out there?
That's a really interesting question. And it's not something that we dig into in terms of index construction. But for me, one of the real keys, just as I think about which space companies are more likely to be successful, one of the keys is having a management team that understands that geopolitical environment that I was referring to earlier, that understands, you know, even if they just stay within a single country, they have to understand that country's priorities, needs, and everything else. Because the way the whole space environment is set up, you know, going back to the Outer Space Treaty in the mid 20th century, you know, you have national oversight over all space activities for, you know, the companies within that nation. So you better stay on your government's good side. And so, you know, there's that part of it, but then there's also, well, how do you engage in global trade? Because this is one of the key selling points of space, right? The satellites are up in space. They're able to pass over the entire planet and do what they do. So where's your global marketing strategy? Yeah, how do you meet the needs of all those different customers all over the world in a way that makes good financial sense? And so that's one of the things that I always look for in companies is, you know, are they really just going back to that one customer or one set of customers, or is the management team really looking and seeing, you know, we have a whole world of opportunities. You know, how are we going to do that, and in what order, and how do we prioritize, and where do we go from here? And the good ones are thinking about those things.
I hope that was pun intended, a world of opportunities. If it wasn't, it was excellently placed. Now let's talk about a couple of the positions, you know, Micah, that's in the index right now. I saw that one of your largest holdings is Sky Perfect, which is a foreign-based satellite TV company. Can you tell us just a little bit about this company or why you're interested in it?
Well, the short answer is they met the criteria for inclusion in the index.
There we go. So,
you know, rules-based index. Yeah, there we go. But yeah, one of the things I would point out is that, you know, not just Sky Perfect, but if you look at the top 10 holdings, you know, in the index as an example, you know, usually it's going to be around 7 of them are going to be satellite operators in one form or another. It could be communications, it could be satellite TV, as you mentioned, could be something like Earth observation. And then you'll typically have maybe one or two that are on the ground services. So you think about, you know, Garmin or Trimble as an example, or, you know, companies that are doing things with the GPS chips or chips that tie into other constellations of satellites do more or less the same thing, because GPS isn't the only one out there. And it's about, you know, these are both consumer companies and you know, business to business companies. So, you know, they're helping agriculture, shipping, logistics, surveying, you know, all of these other applications. And then you'll often find maybe one hardware manufacturer up there in that top 10. So, you know, as I say, for now, that's how it looks. It's going to be really interesting as more of these new companies start trading publicly. And yes, as Andrew mentioned, you know, we're watching them and, you know, keeping track of them as we get ready to do the next reconstitution for the index. And I do think we're going to see that shift. I don't know what the balance is ultimately going to look like, but I get the feeling that it's going to change. And we're going to see more of that, you know, vertically integrated company combination of hardware manufacturing and operations.
Is there any industries that you think are very likely to embrace these technologies that maybe aren't doing it as much as the comms companies or the imaging companies are? Is there a next industry that embraces outer space as a supplement to how they're doing things today?
I mean, the one that really comes to mind, and it's because it's, you know, a matter of great national debate at the moment, is infrastructure. So you think about all of the infrastructure needs that just exist in the United States. And yes, you know, this is a global challenge again. You know, how do we build infrastructure for the future that is resilient, sustainable, cost-effective to operate, you know, all these other things. But for me, I'm thinking about, well, what role does space play in this? Because you can have space-enabled sensors that are built into that infrastructure, whether it's monitoring a bridge so that, you know, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, you can actually see that you have a problem before it breaks. You know, things like that affect people's lives. They save lives and save, you know, tremendous amounts of money too, if they're, you know, treated properly. You know, being able to take that data and turn it into meaningful insights. So, you know, that's a huge opportunity. And I would love to see more of that happening. And, you know, and so there are elements of communications in there, because, you know, you can have satellites providing the backbone for, you know, getting that data back to wherever it belongs from the road or bridge or pipeline. But then you can also do a great deal with the imagery side and the remote sensing. And so, you know, as these capabilities continue to evolve, you know, can you see a road surface beginning to buckle from space? I mean, we're getting to the point where spacecraft can actually do that. So, you know, again, how does that change the way countries and governments operate? How does that change the way we decide how to travel? I don't know the answers to these things, and I just look forward to finding out.
I'll throw one too. You know, China's announced that they want to create you know, the ability to harness solar energy and send it from space down to Earth. You know, what kind of, you know, disruptions, you know, could that do for the overall energy infrastructure and the grid? Is it, you know, disrupting renewables? Is it disrupting, you know, traditional, you know, energy sources and power plants or whatnot? You know, we'll have to see. You know, would it go into your car, you know, straight from space? You know, that sounds like we're even further away from that becoming a reality. But, you know, certainly, you know, could that disrupt an entire energy industry and infrastructure? You know, there's many projects that are going on. Some will be successful, some won't. Some will take, you know, much longer than we could ever, you know, imagine. And some might be, you know, just a matter of figuring out that technological innovation that makes something, you know, actually viable. And so, you know, these are tasks that, you know, large organizations, governments, agencies are trying to tackle today. And if they're successful, you know, who knows where that next innovation is going to come from. But some of these have, you know, pretty big implications and ramifications. Hopefully it's all done safely.
I love that. I love the things that sound crazy today actually being innovative and taking shape in the future. Go back and watch the Jetsons for anyone listening to this podcast. You know, things that were crazy and being put into cartoons actually happened a couple of decades later. I've got two more questions. The first one's a fun one for you. I always like to ask a fun question for you on the podcast that's totally off script. This question is 0 to 100%. I'll ask it to each of you. What is the likelihood that you personally go on a space tourism flight by the year 2030? You are shipped up into outer space for a space tourism flight. I hope you get a window seat if you take one.
So zero for me. And the reason is I really like Earth. I do. It's just, it's been a good planet for me. And I'd like to stay on it a little bit longer. I think maybe later in life, I would consider something like that, because it's probably still going to be high risk for a while. And there are other things I want to do first. But yeah, great that other people are giving it a try and enjoying it, you know, by the looks of things. So, you know, certainly keen to see that industry continue to grow and prosper and gain plenty of operational experience.
Fair enough, Mike. How about you, Andrew?
I thought I told you I wasn't allowed to give projections, but I think this one's
we
okay.
We won't hold you to this one.
I think worry. This one's okay. Yep. So, you know, if the ticket was free, I think I'd be willing to go a lot sooner. You know, by the year 2030, it depends on how big my family is and how many people are, you know, dependent upon my survival and existence. So all those would probably factor in. That said, you know, there's a company today that's trying to build a space hotel that orbits Earth, kind of like a space station for tourists. And, you know, that's a completely different type of experience than hopping in a craft and going up and getting some, you know, a couple seconds, minutes, and, you know, zero gravity, weightlessness kind of experience. You know, maybe that would be something that would be pretty interesting. Spend a couple of days up in space. But I think one of the neatest things that we're seeing about space tourism is that, you know, someone that had, you know, all the dreams and goals and put, you know, did all the work and everything that it takes to be an astronaut, you know, those very few people, you know, have the ability to claim that they're an astronaut. And many people, there's an age cutoff where, you know, basically if you haven't been an astronaut yet, you're not going to space. And, you know, for many people, like we saw with Wally Funk, you know, even the billionaires that are going to space, many of them probably wouldn't have been able to go to space just on age alone for some types of missions. And, you know, we're getting valuable, you know, research and information about, you know, health and its effects, you know, for age and space and things like that. And I think, you know, this is kind of, you know, a pretty neat experience that people of, you know, almost any age now have the ability to go to space if they can afford it. So what's the percentage by 2030, you said? If the ticket's free, I'd say 61%.
61 for a free ticket. Okay. Didn't even specify free in the original question, but if it was, 60% seems pretty promising. Last question for you, you know, and I'll frame this one a little bit too, is looking for kind of specific things that we're tracking out there as this industry evolves. I'll put myself first to answer this one, that one thing I've been watching is kind of the cost per kilogram of launches into space for not only ride sharing, which was kind of the only option for so many years, but now even for dedicated launches, those have been coming down quite a bit because of the miniaturization of satellites, you know, the reusable rockets, various factors are pushing down the prices of launch, which is making it commercially viable. That's something I've been keeping an eye on. Are there any things that you are watching as this industry evolves that you think investors should also have on their radar? Could be broad, could be specific, as much as you like.
I know Micah Pryor knows my answer. It's the militarization of space. And that is something that is already happening today. It's still in its early stages, but for decades, the military has already relied on space. So the military, probably more than any other agency organization in the world, understands how important space is. And space has now become this new battlefield and frontier that countries are competing in. And you know what the U.S. does whenever there's a new frontier, it's spend more than your adversaries. And so if that continues to be the case for space, as China, Russia, India, Europe, and beyond increase their capabilities, their desires, and their goals to be, you know, the dominant players in space, you know, that's something that could certainly lead to, you know, more spending towards the militarization of space. So the question is, how do governments around the world look to participate and grow in space? Is it done amicably and we share resources and we can do things, you know, with similar goals? Or is it where, you know, there's an adversarial nation that wants to be first and wants to use that power that it's obtained by being the dominant space player, and how it allows other countries, companies, individuals to access space? So I think this is something that we need to be paying more attention to. It's something that's absolutely critical for humanity's future in space. And it's another potential area where we could see more spending if nations say, hey, we need to, you know, this is the new arms race and we need to be the winner here.
You're absolutely right. There is a huge challenge that's been issued and being reissued every day, it seems, as nations deal with each other in space. I think for me, the thing that I'm watching right now is a different kind of competition. And it's the competition to be the place on Earth where everyone wants to go to do space-related things. And so you think about how, even for all the arguments that, oh, this is no longer true anymore, if you want to do software, you go to Silicon Valley. They have the ecosystem, they have the funding, they have everything else. What's the equivalent for space? It's not clear yet where that is. Yes, there are clusters of industry and activity, you know, around spaceports. But even then, most of the spaceports don't have a lot of the manufacturing. That's often elsewhere in the country. And, you know, same goes true for other countries, not just the US. And so we're seeing a lot of local communities kind of step up and say, you know, we need an economic engine for our community's future. And we're not entirely sure what this whole space thing is and how it works and whether it's any good or not, but it sounds interesting. and we want to know more, and we're going to explore this. And I suspect that what is going to happen is we're going to see some of those communities get it right and figure out, you know, how do you build space companies that from their very outset are embedded in communities and in community needs and engagement with all the other sectors that exist in that community, and can then take that expertise and send it around the world and make money and, you know, actually do it profitably, because that's really important too. So that is something that I'm looking at, and that's probably even farther in the future, being able to look back and say, now I see, you know, it's this one town or this county or state or even small country possibly, that really got the blend right, that figured out how to do this in a way that has secured their future, their economic future and their community's future. And that's something that, you know, we're very much engaged with in Kaelus Partners. We're doing, you know, projects for a few different places around the world, you know, working with communities like that. And that's one of the things that I'm just personally very excited about, to see how those groups of people come to grips with the challenges and the opportunities in space and chart their own future. And being a part of it is just, it's fantastic.
Yeah, it sure is. There certainly is a lot of brain power addressing the space economy, right? You look at companies that have been created by the world's most successful entrepreneurs, whether it's Elon Musk, Richard Branson, Jeff Bezos, they've been very successful in building Earth-based businesses, but their baby, you can tell in the passion that they have, is in outer space. And it's really interesting and exciting to see them setting their sights on the commercial space economy. So once again, everybody listening, it's been Andrew Channon. He is the founder and CEO of Procure AM, and Michael Walter Range, the president of Kaelus Partners, also advisor to Procure AM. They've together created the world's first space-based ETF. The ticker on that is UFO. Hey, Andrew and Mike, I always have a lot of fun with these conversations. Thanks very much for joining our 7 Investing podcast.
Thank you.
It's been great. Thanks.
And thanks for everybody for tuning in to this edition of our 7 Investing podcast. We are here to empower you to invest in your future. We are 7 Investing.